Norman Century's Episode 3, Richard the Good, Inventing the Past.
Welcome back. Last time we talked about Richard the Fearless, who was the first to take the title of Duke, and was in a way the first historical leader of Normandy. It was under his son Richard II, however, that the Normans finally gained their identity. In a sense, it's when the Normans created themselves. This was oddly enough in large part due to the Kingdom of England. Most people are probably aware of the Battle of Hastings and the Norman role in creating England, but a much more surprising fact is that the reverse is also true. England played a crucial role in the creation and defining of Normandy. So before we get to the reign of Richard II, we must first look at the British Isles. England had borne the brunt of the first Viking raids in the 9th century, and it proved so tempting to the Scandinavians that a great Viking army had invaded with the intention of completely conquering it. The English were hampered by the fact that they were split into several kingdoms at the time, 7 is the traditional number, and within a few years only the southern kingdom of Wessex was left. It seemed a matter of time before that fell as well, but fortunately for the Anglo-Saxons, the king of Wessex was a brilliant strategist named Alfred, and he managed to fight the Vikings to a standstill. During the course of his reign, he managed to turn the balance of power in his favor, and slowly but surely pushed back the Norse invaders. He was so successful that he earned the title of the Great, the only English monarch to accomplish that. But more importantly for us, he convinced the Vikings that England was no longer such easy pickings. The next wave of invaders, including the adventurer Rollo, decided to try their luck in France. Alfred's son continued his father's efforts, even extending English control into Scotland, where he received the submission of the Scottish king and declared himself King of all Britain. Under a strong monarchy, commerce replaced raiding, and by the time Richard I was reigning in Normandy, England was fabulously wealthy. It was not, however, particularly well governed, as the English were about to find out. Unfortunately for everyone involved, a fresh wave of Viking activity hammered northern Europe, and both Richard I and his English counterpart King Ethelred had to deal with it. You can usually tell how competent a ruler is by the nicknames they're given, and poor Ethelred does not fare well in this respect. His predecessors get titles like Great, Magnificent, and Glorious, but he had to make do with Ethelred the Unready. That's actually an old English pun on the king's name. Ethelred means wise counsel, and unread translates to something like uncounseled. You can almost hear the long-suffering English muttering, wise counsel? More like no counsel. The king earned this reputation because he dealt with the Viking threat by bribing the looters to leave. Unsurprisingly, this was neither a popular nor a particularly effective solution. Raiders who had come in search of plunder discovered an endless supply of easy money. Just hop off your longboat, burn a few villages, and wait for the king's representative to show up with the gold to buy you off. All of this was, of course, paid by the common man, who now had to pay a new tax called the Danegeld. Not only was it tremendously expensive, but since it tended to draw invaders instead of discouraging them, it was also completely demoralizing. The English kingdom was wealthy, weak, and notably defeatist, all of which meant that the attacks would continue. Across the Channel in Normandy, Duke Richard I was facing the lesser but related problem of what to do about the Vikings. Despite their shared cultural heritage, the last thing the Norman Duke wanted was a group of uncontrollable Vikings upsetting trade and wandering through his territory. He was, after all, a civilized Christian ruler, and could hardly welcome pagan raiders into his territory without raising suspicions among the surrounding French. Furthermore, there was nothing to guarantee that the Vikings wouldn't turn on him. They wanted plunder, and Normandy had plenty of it. He was still wondering what to do when the Vikings forced his hand by requesting access to his ports to sell the ill-gotten goods they had plundered from England. The aging Richard was caught in a dilemma. Actively resist and draw Viking ire, or assist them and confirm the dark rumors already swirling that the Vikings were nothing more than pirates themselves. It had to be decided soon. The Vikings were not ones to be kept waiting. Perhaps it was because he still felt a distant kinship to the Norse, Or perhaps he was trying to avoid becoming a target himself. But whatever the reason, Richard I opened the ports and braced himself for the inevitable controversy. It erupted almost immediately. The English in particular were horrified that a fellow Christian prince was providing hospitality for the very raiders that were despoiling their nation, and sent a frantic appeal to the Pope to bring the Normans back in line. The Pope was reluctant to do this. He was engaged in a struggle to reform the church, and the Normans were greatly aiding this in their territory. But the scandal was so intense that a papal representative was dispatched, and the Duke reluctantly signed an agreement to stop harboring Ethelred's enemies. He could hardly, however, break off relations completely. He instructed his merchants to continue trading, and 5 years later died, leaving the issue to his son. It was a smooth transition of power. Despite the fact that the 33-year-old Richard II was technically illegitimate. Important marriages were always political matches, and the Norman dukes took the same approach to their mistresses, living openly with them and considering their offspring legitimate. The general population seems to have accepted this as a relic of the old pagan days, and been content enough to let such things slide. Once installed in the ducal palace, however, Richard II was faced with his first test. Drawn by decades of easy English loot, a huge Danish army descended on Wessex in 996 and began a 3-year systematic plundering of the kingdom. By the time that Ethelred had gathered enough money to convince them to leave, the Vikings had decided that they needed a base to continue further attacks. Approaching Rouen, they asked Richard II for permission to land in Normandy. Richard was now caught in the same quandary as his father, and unsurprisingly, he came to the same conclusions. In England, Ethelred the Unready was starting to panic. He had emptied the treasury to force the Vikings away, only to see them get a friendly reception just across the channel and continue their attacks. He had to find some way to close the Norman ports, and obviously an appeal to the Pope had not proved overly effective. So the king tried his hand at diplomacy. Richard II had an unmarried sister named Emma, and Ethelred offered to marry her if the Normans would agree to shut the door to the Norse. This was too good of an opportunity for Richard to miss, certainly worth risking offending the Vikings, so Emma was dutifully packed off to London. The diplomatic triumph went straight to Ethelred's head. Confident that he had solved the Viking menace at last, the king carried out a surprise massacre of the Danes living in the southwest of England, then mustered a huge fleet to hold off any Danish retribution. When some months passed, with no Viking attempt at revenge, Ethelred decided to put his navy to use settling some old scores. Richard II may have been a useful recent ally, but the Normans had stood back for years while the Norse tormented England, and the time had come for a little payback. A detachment was sent to raid the coast, but it turned into a debacle when the Norman cavalry showed up faster than anticipated. Perhaps the most enduring Norman military trait was their adaptability. Their heavy cavalry charge was virtually irresistible, but the army could also dismount to fight with swords, shoot arrows, throw their lances, or any combination of the above. The English contingent, by contrast, mostly on foot, was fighting on ground they didn't know and were not nearly as maneuverable. Ethelred's entire fleet met disaster, but by then he had larger problems. The Danish massacre had given Svein Forkbeard, the king of Denmark, the perfect excuse to invade, and since Richard II had been needlessly antagonized, Svein was welcomed to Rouen with open arms. A formal alliance between the two was concluded, and an oath of perpetual peace was sworn. Svein proceeded to England, where he found an unexpectedly easy conquest. The English were quite tired of their weak king, and since Svein was already a Christian, he wasn't met with the usual suspicion accorded a Viking. There was little real resistance. By the end of the year, the Dane was sitting on the English throne, and Ethelred, Emma, and their two young sons were living in a rather awkward exile in Normandy. Richard II seems to have realized rather quickly that he had gone too far in actually making a treaty with the Scandinavians. Norman dukes had always tried hard to pretend that they were proper French nobility, but the surrounding people were deeply suspicious of their Norse ancestry. Now it seemed as if the Norman inner Viking was revealed for all to see. Good Christian French princes didn't go around making treaties with Viking kings or trade with Viking pirates, and they certainly didn't use Viking mercenaries to threaten other Christians. When Richard II brought in Norse warriors, including, by the way, Olaf, the future patron saint of Norway, to help him in a border skirmish, the French were horrified. Under the command of the nominally Christian Olaf, a largely pagan Viking force plundered their way across Brittany to a meeting with the Norman duke, and sat menacingly across a river while the French king hastily brokered a treaty to Richard's advantage. Just as bad, in the French view, as the shameful behavior of Richard, was the conduct of his sister Emma. Within 2 years of her exile, her husband Ethelred and his rival Svein Forkbeard were dead, and Emma abandoned her two young sons to marry the new Viking king of England. The boys, one of which was the future King Edward the Confessor, were left to fend for themselves, effectively disowned in a foreign land. Normandy was clearly being drawn into the Scandinavian orbit and gaining a reputation as little better than half-civilized Vikings themselves. Something would have to be done to refurbish their tarnished image, so Richard II commissioned the first ducal historian to craft a pro-French history of the duchy. What better way to combat the negative PR than with a little spin of his own? Norman history was given a complete retooling. Rollo acquired a high birth in Norway. His fierce son, William Longsword, was transformed into a gentle ruler, a monk at heart, and a lover of peace, who died a martyr's death. Richard I was a paragon of virtue, fighting equally to reform the church and maintain his independence from the powerful North. Of course, the tendency of the dukes to have public mistresses was a bit embarrassing, but they were given the title Danish wives and explained away as holdovers from the old Norse pagan days when they didn't know any better. Even Richard II's mother got a complete makeover. She was the daughter of a powerful vassal of Richard I, who had become the duke's mistress to cement ties with her father. Now, however, she was a humble forester's daughter who had met the duke by chance on a hunting trip and captured his heart with her beauty and virtue. These were the ancestors that an ambitious duke needed, worthy of even the proudest French noble, and they gave Richard II the credibility he desired. From his court at Rouen, he handed out titles, appointing viscounts, seneschals, and constables in a quantity that not even the King of France could match. Norman forces seemed to be everywhere, intervening in neighboring squabbles, pressing ducal claims, and expanding the territory of Normandy. The message Richard was sending was clear. These were the actions of one of the great lords of France, and, even if uncrowned, he was nearly the equal of the king. By the time he died of natural causes at the age of 64, Richard II had managed to turn the perception of Normandy from a rogue Viking state into one of the most powerful provinces of France. He was a personal friend of the French king, the brother-in-law of the English king, and had at least 5 grown sons to carry on his line. His subjects remembered him fondly as Richard the Good, and, one suspects, would have even without the pandering court historians. More than any other duke, he had been responsible for creating an identity for his people, and had provided the foundations for the greater heights yet to come. Join me next time as I talk about his son Robert, who claimed the duchy as his inheritance, a man whose own subjects called him both Robert the Magnificent and Robert the Devil.
Norman Centuries is a podcast written and recorded by Lars Brownworth, author of the book Lost to the West and creator of the 12 Byzantine Rulers podcast. Visit us online at normancenturies.com.